As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
Muddy Knees Media.
This Christmas / Hanukkah / Winterval / holiday season, The Athletic wants you to bog off. Because when you buy one annual subscription, you'll get another one for free. And similarly, when you gift a year's subscription, you can get one for yourself at no extra cost. So wave goodbye to 2020 and say hello to 2021 by sharing the gift of The Athletic's unrivaled football coverage with analysis and in-depth features from the very best writers around, exclusive Q&As with Athletic staff, and ad-free versions of all of The Athletic's podcasts, including this one. Find out more and sign up today at theathletic.com/galazzo.
Today on Galazzo, some sinister business as we look back on the many lives of Mihailovic, prodigy, hard man, suspected racist, serial spitter, leukemia survivor, and for some, the greatest taker of free kicks ever seen. Bondi! Gentile ascoltatore, welcome to Galazzo. Just me and James Horncastle today. Gab's sitting this one out. Hello, James.
Hello, Jimbo. Bit of Sven, though, coming in.
There's a bit of Sven and other bits, too. And one very big topic to talk about, Sinisa Mihailovic. A guy who's done so much, James, that you almost forget how much he's done.
Well, indeed. I mean, one of the quotes to start his book is that life is an impenetrable miracle. And I think in some respects, Mihailovic it has many shades to it, which, you know, I think require deep exploration. Because with Mihailovic, I think he is one of those people that certainly outside of Italy, outside of Serbia, lots of people have a... they seem to have already formed their opinions of. They've kind of rushed to judgment about him. And, you know, I think maybe over the course of this podcast, we will we'll get closer to the actual core of the man, the truth of the man, whilst also referring to his core, because he talks a hell of a lot about his sculpted marble abs and how that core strength was one of the secrets behind that free kick-taking technique, James.
Cover a lot of ground there. You've been reading his book, as have I, La Partita della Vita, the game of my life, really, which itself covers a lot of ground. This is a gentleman who won the European Cup, age just 21, who lived through the Yugoslav Civil War with a Serb father and a Croatian mother, who became the best set-piece taker ever in Serie A, that's right, ever. And, as we mentioned, perhaps his greatest achievement, coaching Bologna to a miracle season while battling leukemia. You may not like Sinisa. Many times I've quite actively disliked him. But you'll recognise, I'm sure, that his is a remarkable story. All right, it's the 1980s. In the former Yugoslavia, and a young Sinisa Mihailovic is growing up in Borova near Novi Sad, possibly enjoying, like other youths, the early electropop stylings of Yugoslav duo Denis and Denis, here with hit of the mid-80s, Program Tvog Komjutera. program your computer. Yugoslavia, as Sinisa himself puts it, was 6 states, 5 nations, 4 languages, 3 religions, and 2 alphabets, all held together by only one man, Marshal Tito. And the death of President for Life Tito in 1980 would begin that country's slow slide into bitter civil war. Sinisa just remembers it as bringing an extra day off school. In his biography, he recalls a simple adolescence, James, spent largely smacking the ball into a garage door for hours on end while he wasn't carving a name out for himself in various youth football teams.
Yeah, he used to get up at 6 in the morning as a kid. When I was his age, I would just have lie-ins all the time if I wasn't at school. And yet he would get up. His dad bought him a kind of old school leather ball from the flea market. And he would just smash it at the garage door. And this was much to the kind of annoyance of his neighbours. Was it Dragan, who basically went and worked at the shoe factory?
Everybody did.
He did the night shift, and he would get in at around the time that Sinisa would be practising his shooting and wouldn't be able to get to sleep. So he kind of said, look, Sinisa, just make sure you pick the right team. You have to go to the team I support, Partizan Belgrade. And of course, Sinisa was never going to do that because he grew up worshipping Red Star.
Red Star indeed. Incredible group of players who were coming up at this time right across Yugoslavia. Mihalovic, Zvonimir Boban, Prozineski, Davosuka, Mijatovic, Jani, Jugovic as well, Alan Boksic too. Many of whom were part of that incredible generation that went with the Yugoslav under 20 team and won the World Cup in 1987 in Chile. And one of the points that Sinisa makes about the war is how it actually robbed the game of one of the greatest national sides that ever existed. All of us young, as he puts it, all of us with 10, 15 years of possible successes ahead of us. But after 1992, that group of players never played together again. 92 is when they really would have had their chance at greatness on the senior level. The Euros, which we all remember as the Danish fairy tale, but was rather different for Sinisa and co, who were in their retiro in their hotel in Sweden, ready for the championships, and then told that not only were they kicked out of the tournament, but they had to get back to Serbia by midnight before the no-fly zone was imposed.
Yeah, and they had this legendary pilot, didn't they, apparently, Popov, who managed to get them back. I think he advised that they basically fill the petrol tank on the plane only sort of half full so they would be able to get there quicker, and yet someone filled it all the way. So that slowed them down. And then they were strafed by some MiG fighter jets.
I don't think they actually got strafed, but certainly the MiG jets were flying alongside them and gesticulating for them to take it down. And Popov says no. And Mihalovic says, I was sat in the cockpit with him saying, what are you doing? Take us down. And Popov says, we're a national football team. They'll never shoot us down. And of course, they didn't. But extraordinary scenes.
Yeah, and the source of regret, I suppose, is that Denmark went on to win that competition and they finished ahead of Denmark in their group. They won 7 games. I think they only lost 1. So an almost perfect record. And for Sinisa, I think the reason why that is such a source of regret was because he didn't play in the under 20 World Cup winning team that preceded this a couple of years prior because he turned down the chance to go to Dinamo Zagreb. And, you know, he feels that in rejecting them and the kind of clout and power that they had within the federation, it was the reason behind his non-selection. So, you know, watching, you know, his teammates in a bar basically cry with joy and lift the World Cup, I think is still a success that he really, really wanted to be a part of.
Mm-hmm. He turned down Dinamo Zagreb because he wanted to stay with his local side, Vojvodina, who rather improbably, with him in the first team at the age of just 19, swept to the Yugoslav league title ahead of the big 4 Yugo clubs, Dinamo Zagreb, Hajduk Split, Red Star Belgrade and Partizan Belgrade.
A Leicester-style fairy tale, James, because Vojvodina were promoted in the year that he joined them after turning down all those Deutschmarks in a suitcase or briefcase, at least, from Dinamo Zagreb. And Yeah, I think they'd only won the league title once before mm-hmm. under someone whose destiny he'd also crossed, which was Vujadin Boskov.
Vujadin Boskov. What a legendary figure he was. And yes, he will crop up again soon enough. Anyway, Mihailović then joins Red Star Belgrade and at the age of 21 becomes European champion with them, part of, again, an incredible lineup. Savicevic was there, Prozineski, Jugovic, Darko Panchev, the Cobra, who of course Rangers fans will recall for the goals he scored against them, knocking them out of that European Cup.
Darko Panchev, who would go on to play for Inter, and the Cobra became the Grass Snake. He was so tame in Serie A.
So Grasshoppers were knocked out by Red Star, Rangers as well, then Dinamo Dresden in the quarters before the side from Belgrade met Bayern Munich in the semi-finals. Jupp Heynckes in charge, big names in their team, of course, Jürgen Kohler, Stefan Reuter, Stefan Effenberg as well, Brian Laudrup, and the boys from Bavaria, very much favourites. But Red Star got a 2-1 win in Munich, and then the return leg turned out to be something pretty special from this young fellow they'd signed called Sinisu Mihailović. Well, if you don't speak Serb, that's them saying incredible. Mihailović with the free kick opening goal there. And he was to get, or at least set up, the second Red Star goal, which took them through a dramatic injury time winner, which he bounced off Klaus Augenthaler.
Yeah, and this was when Sinisa was a guy who used to wear the number 11 shirt. Now he was a winger with long hair. It's not the kind of character that we later grew accustomed to, I suppose, in Serie A. But yeah, the Maracanã that night, I think there were 80,000 fans there, but it felt considerably more. And you know, in terms of the most kind of intimidating atmospheres, and how I suppose the fear that place puts into opponents, no matter how kind of storied. I mean, that Bayern side had absolutely romped through the competition so far. You mentioned that they were favourites. I think they'd scored 17 goals and conceded only 3 on their way to that semi final. And there's that incredible video on YouTube of walking down the long walk in the tunnel at the Maracanã, where you have to kind of pass under the end where all the Red Star ultras are standing, and it feels like you're walking, you know, a mile or two rather than, you know, however long it is to get onto the pitch. And it just, I don't think I'd be able to get out of the bathroom, let alone get onto the pitch if I were an opponent playing Red Star in those days.
Well, even if you were a Red Star player, particularly a young debutant like Sinisa was the first couple of times he made an appearance at the Maracanã. Woof. Well, there they were, through to the final in Bari, which, if memory serves, James, turned out to be the worst European final ever played. Would you agree? Went to penalties with Marseille.
Yeah, I think it undoubtedly was. I mean, apparently the kind of coach's strategy for that game was like, look, I've watched a lot of Marseille this year, and you know, when they have the ball, it's not a problem because we can defend really, really well. The problem's when we have the ball, because if we give it away, they'll basically counter, or they're too good and they'll score on us. So let's just give them the ball.
Which is exactly what Mourinho did with Inter, of course, up against Barcelona and then Bayern Munich.
Yeah, who would have thought that this would be a source of inspiration for him? Also, you know, I think a number of Red Star players have said that, you know, I think there was a sense that someone was trying to buy them as well and fix the game in Marseille's favour. And, you know, they rejected that offer. And, you know, they looked at it as, look, we're a young side. We've got a shot at history. We've still got lots and lots of time to earn money. So let's try and win this, and win it they did.
Well, indeed. I have to say, I can't think of many more dangerous things to do than throw a game for Red Star, given who was in charge of their ultras the group that was to become the paramilitaries known as the Tigers. And I'm referring to Arkan or Zeljko Raznatovic, who at the time was kind of a local crime lord, Kapo Tivozi IV Red Star, and then later an indicted war criminal in the bitter civil war. He's somebody that Sinisa met almost immediately on joining Red Star. After a slightly fractious beginning, they became firm friends, and he's someone who will crop up in our story, of course, later on. By the following season, anyway, after the European triumph, civil war had broken out throughout the former Yugoslavia. Sinisa, by this point, had about 50 relatives, by his reckoning, including his uncle, who'd had to be rescued, his uncle being Croatian, by Arkan and his forces, and who'd been spared because he said, no, Sinisa's my nephew. And he and many others were living in Sinisa's apartment in Belgrade, while Mihalovic himself holed up in a local hotel. Anyway, by the following summer, that Red Star team had been broken up as well. Savicevic moves to Milan, Jugovic to Sampdoria, Darko Panchev to Inter, and keen on finding a nice calm club and city, Sinisa goes to Rome.
This episode is supported by Season 3 of FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Celebrity owners Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds' small-town Welsh football club has finally been promoted into League 2 after 15 seasons in the National League. Dedicated staff and supporters celebrate the city's return to glory while bracing for the newfound challenges that come with being in a higher division. Will Wrexham AFC stand up to the challenges and rise again into League 1? FX's Welcome to Wrexham premieres May 2nd on FX. Stream on Hulu. You're listening to Galazzo, the totally Italian football show, part of the Athletic Podcast Network.
Eduardo Benato with Il Paese dei Balocchi. Roma in 1992 was an interesting club. This was just when I arrived in the city, and it was, it made quite an impression on me. Owned by Ciarapico, who would shortly be behind bars for his involvement in the whole Mani Puliti corruption scandal. Managed by our friend, the Yugoslav fox Vujadin Boskov. They had players like Giannini, Il Principe, Ruggero Rizzirizzigo Rizziteli, Andrea Carnevali, Pluto Aldair, also Caniggia, who was always out partying and got a ban for cocaine during this season as well. Basically, it was a pretty mad club to join. And I remember actually Mihalovic, the new boy, who was, 22 years old, turning up at this club, which was one of the biggest sides in Italy. And I remember reading this headline of an interview with him in Gazetta, kind of introducing himself, where he says, yeah, for me, free kicks are like penalties. I score one in every two. I mean, apart from the fact that's not actually a great penalty-taking record, the crazy thing is his free kick record was actually better than that.
Yeah, and he talks about his technique as very much like taking a penalty, in that he is watching the goalkeeper right until the final second. So if there's any movement, he will go back to where the goalkeeper was coming to catch him off guard. And if he stays rooted to his spot, he'll try and find the far corner instead. I mean, he holds the record in Serie A for the most free kick goals with 28. It's one more than Andrea Pirlo, even though Pirlo played a lot more games in Serie A than he did. And of course, you know, he is, I think, still the only player to score a hat trick of goals. Obviously, we'll get to that because it came later.
Well, let's talk about it. I mean, let's talk about his free kicks. Yeah, Giuseppe Signori scored a hat trick of free kicks in a match, but two of those were indirect free kicks. Mihalovic is the only player ever to score three times from a direct free kick. The only player to come close is Mihalovic himself, much later on when he was at Inter. Perhaps we'll touch on that in a second or two. But in 14 seasons at Roma and then under Sven-Göran Eriksson and later Roberto Mancini at Sampdoria and Lazio, and then under Mancini again at Inter, he scores 28 free kick goals, eight of them in one season, and as you mentioned, three in just the one game, which was 13th of December 1998, a 5-2 victory over Sampdoria, who he'd recently left to join Lazio. When you look at the kicks as well, it's striking how I mean, they really display his versatility.
Here is Mihailovic. Oh! That's fantastic. Bet beyond the keeper. And right into the corner from the master of that kind of situation.
I think Mancini on the day of this game bet him €1 million a goal, not thinking he was going to score. And yet Sinisa comes away with a hat trick and asks, where's his money afterwards? And Mancini says, you also let in a goal. And I think he let in two goals. And so I'll give you €1 million. I think this must have been the time when lira was around. Surely it's pre-euro because that would be crazy. But I think Mihailovic still wants Mancini to pay up. But yeah, I mean the technique is incredible. It's so incredible, so varied as you say that. You know, when he was a kid coming through the ranks in Serbia, the University of Belgrade's physics department basically said, Sinisa, we want to sort of run experiments and see how hard you're hitting the ball, how quick it's going, you know, how you're basically able to manipulate it and affect these the trajectory and the movement of the ball. So yeah, I suppose if you're having academic study your own technique and defying the law of physics, then that really is quite something. I was surprised to learn that he, a little bit like Beppe Signori, has relatively small feet. Yeah, he's got size 8 feet.
He wears his boots, like Signori, a size smaller.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if you've interviewed Mihailovic, James, but he's a tall and imposing guy. He doesn't look like someone who's got small feet.
Dainty feet. No, I have actually. And do you know what? I actually interviewed him after he scored this hat-trick of free kicks.
Oh, wow.
And if you'll excuse his Italian, this is what he said.
Sì, per me, giocare calcio... Se forse non esistono punizioni, io non so se giocherei calcio. Andrei a giocare football americano. Ci sono quelli che stanno là solo per buttare quella palla più avanti.
I asked him, do you dream about free kicks at night? You seem to spend a lot of time thinking about them. He said, if there weren't free kicks, I wouldn't play football. There you go. He said, I'd probably play American football and be like a punter or a place kicker. Anyway, I made that assertion at the start, and I'm not the only one, that he is the greatest free kick taker ever, certainly in Serie A. And when you look at the world's greatest set-piece specialists, you've got Zico, Zola, Maradona, Beckham, of course, Pirlo, Juninho Pernambucano. This figure of Mihailovic, a sort of tough guy, short-tempered, a centre-back, looks a little bit like an interloper, but the numbers really do back him up. In 637 games in Italy... He scored 67 free kick goals in all competitions. When you look at percentage-wise, that's more than anybody else has managed. Juninho has got more in his career, but a lot of those were in Ligue 1, not against the likes of Buffon and Van der Sar, Toldo, Zenga, etc. And then he had a couple of seasons in. I mean, I think it's a fair point. He also spent a couple of years in Qatar, whereas Serie A was the venue where Mihailovic did his work. I mean, he was exceptional at corners too. He's kind of... Double out with Mancho, the stuff of legends.
Well, and also, you know, obviously, whenever an opponent was kind of game playing against a side that had Sinisa in it, if a free kick was given away, you know, lots of players and managers had different ways to try and combat it. So, like for example, Fabio Cannavaro would pick up the ball and claim that the foul happened further out, but that just kind of helped Sinisa because it was easier to get over the ball. Boban was cleverer in that he would move the ball closer to goal because for the opposite reason. And I think Sinisa looks back and thinks that was the smarter move from Zvonnie. And he also liked the balls really pumped up as well. So Carlo Mazzone, who had him at Roma, whenever he used to come up against him when he was manager of sort of Bologna or Brescia, he would make sure that the balls were slightly deflated.
Deflategate.
Yeah, exactly.
The Brady tactic, right. Excellent. It was, if you're curious, Sinisa who provides the corner on Mancini's greatest ever goal, that flying backheel volley against Parma. Anyway, Gianfranco Zola, who's pretty good at set pieces himself, said that he thinks Mihailovic was the best ever. Why is Sinisa not more famous for it worldwide? Well, possibly because he's kind of more famous for other less savoury things.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more. Campionato di calcio
italiano. On Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Smart Speaker, and now ad-free on The Athletic, this is Galazzo, the totally Italian football show.
Right, here we go then, listener. Yeah, this is the nasty stuff. He's never been short of controversy as Mihalovic. Not sure what your personal highlights would be of his checkered career,
low
James.
Low lights, James.
Yeah. You got 1998 World Cup when he spits at Yen Yeremis. October 2000, the racist remarks at Patrick Vieira in the Champions League. He subsequently makes a public apology for that, which causes a major split with Lazio's ultras, who are furious with him for, you know, basically apologising.
Yeah, so he has no problem holding his hands up and basically saying, look, I'm wrong. He has his own version of what happened in justification, but that's by the by. And the ultras at Lazio are deeply upset with him and say, you are not coming out in front of us at the Stadio Olimpico with a microphone in hand and apologising for what you said to Patrick Vieira. And as you say, James, I mean, throughout his career, I suppose Mihailovic, wrongly, as we'll get to, is associated with the politics and extremism of elements of that Cordova. And yet they did not have a hand-in-hand relationship as is widely kind of believed or portrayed. On the contrary, it was actually quite fractious.
Mm. Well, yeah, I mean, one example of that, certainly from his account, is the whole business of the banner that the Laziali held up in honour of Arkan the Tiger. So January 2000, Arkan gets assassinated in Belgrade. By this point, he's been an indicted war criminal. I think probably everybody knows the kind of things that he and his Tigers had been involved in. And Mihalovic does take out space in a Serbian newspaper to express his condolences, which raise some eyebrows. But the Irriducibili, one group of the Lazio fans, they decide and they tell Senisa that they're going to put up a banner saying honour to the Tiger Arkan. And he says, do not do this. It's nothing to do with me. Don't do this. But they do it. And there's a major storm. Alessandro Mussolini, the former dictator's granddaughter, who was very much in politics at the time, says honour to the fans for doing this. She thought it was a great idea. But everybody else is outraged, particularly Mihalovic's teammate, Alan Boksic, who, of course, is Croatian, who says that he just felt disgusted and that the supporters had no idea what they're doing. The following weekend, you'll no doubt recall Lazio play away in Turin, where the Torino fans unveil a banner saying, honour to the cat, Sylvester, which I think is probably one of the all-time great bits of tifo. But Mihalovic is very, very clear on the fact that wasn't his idea. The other thing we should mention was one of the most infamous incidents, 2003, when he spat and kicked at Chelsea's Adrian Mutu in a Champions League match and received subsequently an 8-game suspension from UEFA because it was very much not his first offence. It's interesting, though, that both Mutu, later on at Fiorentina, and Patrick Vieira in his final season as a player ended up on the same side as Mihalovic and, by all accounts, had good relationships with him. It was all kind of very much just water under the bridge. Possibly that's more a testament to them than to him, but
well, as well, James, I think as we were talking about when he was up for apologising and did apologise for what he said to Patrick Vieira, he will face up to things and he will try to explain himself or understand where someone else is coming from. And I think, you know, as we're going through his rap sheet, if you call it that, you would think, yeah, it's a lot of these instances are why people lost respect for him or overlooked what a talent he was, not just when it came to bending free kicks over the wall.
Well, indeed. Probably the thing, though, that most definitively cleaned up his image from that racist Serb was to come much later in summer 2019. Campionato di calcio italiano. James, you spoke recently to Sven-Göran Eriksson about Senisa.
Yeah, I spoke to him on the 20th anniversary of Lazio winning the league title in 2000. And Senisa was obviously a big part of that team, and what a team it was. I think we've already spoken about it on other Golazzo episodes. But, when Sven got the job to coach that team, you know, he asked Sergio Craniotti, for two or three players. Sven says that if Craniotti had signed them all at once, they would have won the league for three or four years in a row. And instead, he got Mancini early. I think Mihailovic then came a year later. Mm. And Veron, I think, was the other one he mentions too.
And Sinisa is a winner. He's a fighter and a winner. Mm. If you ask Sinisa today if he can play in Serie A, he would say yes. I'm sure he would. And he thought he was the quickest player in Serie A when I had him. And he was not. He was not even quick. But nobody could beat him, he said. Of course, he was a brilliant football player, and his left foot was out of this world. Mm. But mentally, a winner. To be second, no.
And do you have any special personal memories of him? Specific memories?
Well, I have many memories of him, of course. And, when I came to Sampdoria, he was on loan from Roma as a left winger. Mm. And after a while, I told him, Sinisa, you are not a winger, you're not an attacker, you're a defender. No, he said, no. He's stubborn, like few. At least I got him to play left back, but after a while I saw, no, he's not quick enough there and brilliant with his left foot. But I imagine him as a central defender.
Hmm. Sven-Göran Eriksson sounding in good form there, James. Now, at Sampdoria and later Lazio, as we mentioned, he was Sinisa's manager, and the pair combined, certainly in the capital, for probably the best part of both of their careers in Biancoceleste under Sven and then later under Mancini, in six seasons, Mihailovic picking up the Scudetto, UEFA Cup, Super Cup, the European one, two Italian Super Cups and two Coppa Italias in there. Of course, there was the double season 2000-2001, in which Mihailovic scored a whopping 13 goals. Just a reminder, he was a centre-back. And then he finished off again with Mancini, as mentioned, at Inter, where he could have had another hat-trick. This is another of the few regrets that he has. It's the 04-05 season. He scored two direct free kicks in a single game. The third one comes up, and Adriano insists that he should take it.
To be honest, James, would you begrudge Adriano taking a free kick? I think when we did our special on him, you know, one of the famous moments of Adriano's rapid rise in Serie A was, I think, against Palermo when he hit the bar and he struck the ball so hard. It was something like, I'm exaggerating here, but like 500 kilometers of an hour, and it kind of bounced all the way back beyond the halfway line. But in this case, James, they decided with a good old fun game of rock, paper, scissors.
Right, which Adriano won and missed. But never mind, eh? There were plenty of other free kicks that he did score. Interesting career as a player. I mean, phenomenally successful and very durable as well. One thing that struck you, James, was some of his words about his beginnings in Serie A back at Roma.
Yeah, which did not go well at all. Yeah, first 2 years, he says, the worst 2 years of his career, partly because the war was going on in the background, and he was hosting people who were fleeing conflict, and that wasn't easy mentally. Also, you alluded to it earlier, James, just what a dysfunctional club that Roma were. Between the kind of Dino Viola and Franco Sensi eras, and he walks into a dressing room and has to basically sort of billow out the smoke because he can't see anyone, because everyone in that dressing room is smoking, and you've got Claudio Caniggia kind of picking up tab ends on that were discarded, but were still lit, and saying, why why haven't you smoked this right down to the end? You know, it was that kind of club. It was just remarkable.
For all of that, if he hadn't joined Roma, the course of Italian football would have been completely different because of what happens away at Brescia. Or indeed, before that, when he's standing watching the youth team training. This is Mihailovic's version of events anyway.
Yeah, he never tires of recounting how he gave Francesco Totti his start in life as a footballer at Roma, basically sort of saying that he would watch Roma train the under-19s or even the Allievi, the under-16s at the time, and basically say, "Oh, Boscov, have you seen this kid? This blonde kid, he's pretty special. You should bring him with us when we go and play Brescia at the weekend." And he does. And what I think they're winning comfortably in that game. And Mihailovic basically shouts over to Boscov, "Oi, put the kid on." And the rest is history. But I mean, this is very much something that is a theme throughout Mihailovic's career, not only as a player, but as a manager as well, because, you know, he was the guy who gave Gigio Donnarumma his debut when he was, only, I think, 16.
Yeah, that's true.
At Milan as well. So, you know, this not standing in the way of precocious talent is something that goes to the core of who he is. And also, I think, you know, it's something that, yeah, working under Roberto Mancini towards the end of his time at Inter, when he was an assistant to Mancini, and Mancini has always done that. You know, you look at the work he's done with the national team at the moment, blooding a new generation. You look at how he launched Mario Balotelli's career. You know, that's something I think the two of them have in common.
So Mihailovic as a manager then, after hanging up his boots at Inter, he's become an allenatore with the mixed results. Some highs, keeping Catania up. A fair few lows, like the 9 days he had at Sporting. And also his time in charge of Serbia wasn't particularly happy. He kicked out Adam Lajic from the national side because he didn't sing the national anthem. And then his Serbia lost the playoff for a place at the World Cup against, of all people.
He regularly clashed with Lajic, James.
Right.
There's the story of him at Fiorentina. Basically, he was asked by reporters there, you know, "Why aren't you playing Lajic? He's supposed to be the next big thing out of Partizan Belgrade." And he says, "Well, he's always playing PlayStation and eating chocolate." So, it was, you know, that was quite the dressing down that Mihailovic gave Lajic at the time.
Anyway, his time in charge of the Serbian national side coincides with a playoff defeat to Croatia for a place at the World Cup. After that, you got Sampdoria for a season and a half. Milan, where he got the job ahead of Maurizio Sarri. And he actually had his best win percentage with the Rossoneri, 50%. Lasted almost a full season. Went 1.5 seasons at Torino. As I mentioned, a brief spell in Sporting where a change of ownership saw him out before he'd even begun, really. Before, in January 2019, returning to the club where he'd begun his management career, Bologna. At the time, Bologna looked halfway to Serie B. He had an absolutely remarkable second half of the season with them, keeping them up, finishing, in fact, in 10th place that time. He picked up 22 points with Bologna in the last 10 games of the season, which is a phenomenal rate of return for a team that, as I say, were heading down when he joined them.
Yeah, and just to go back to him getting his first start in Serie A with Bologna, I mean, that was controversial at the time because Bologna is known as La Dotta, La Grassa, La Rossa. You know, it's the red, the fat, and the learned, because it's a university town. It's a left wing town, and there was this, you know, obviously his association with Arkan and nationalism did not go particularly down well there. So that was a short spell at the Dell'Aura, and it's amazing that he's kind of come full circle and is now so well loved and well regarded. You know, even before his illness, you know, you mentioned how well they performed in the second half of that season once he came in for Pippo Inzaghi. But this is kind of what Mihailovic does. I remember the first really good job he did was at Catania when he replaced Gianluca Azzorri at more or less the same time of the season, and everyone thought that Catania were gone. and they had a kind of rousing Girone di Ritorno, the second half of the season with Maxi Lopez up front, and easily stayed up. And you know, I think in those kinds of environments, his kind of backs against the wall mentality works really well. I also thought he did a good job at Milan as well. He got them to a cup final, and then you know Berlusconi sacked him for no apparent reason. You know, even though he put Donnarumma in the team, they were progressing. You know, that was a Milan austerity Milan at the time, where they were really cutting back, and they were just bringing in loans and free transfers. It's a really bad team, which he managed to do something with. But you know, Mihajlovic is right. He's not blowing sort of sunshine up his own ass when he says that Juventus in the last 9 years have twice been in touch with him. First to replace Conte when Conte, at the end of his third season, said, "Do I want to come back? Okay, I'll come back." And it was, you know, whilst he was umming and ahhing that, you know, Juventus contacted him. And then, you know, Conte decides to stay and then resigns at the start of pre-season. And they appointed Allegri. And then when Allegri left as well, he says, you know, that they came in for him ended up going for Sarri. So he's got admirers in high places as Mihajlovic.
And plenty of admirers these days in Bologna as well. Not just because he kept them up in 2018-19, but also because of his remarkable battle against leukemia. Now, I mentioned how, and he kind of cites this as well, and he's not entirely comfortable with it, bless him, the fact that now he's become this kind of almost sainted figure, receiving a special Manager of the Year award for coaching Bologna, even though he was undergoing chemotherapy at the time. But the way that Mihajlovic has been so open and courageous in dealing with such a deadly disease, I think has changed the way many people think about him. From his tearful press conference when he announced that he had this malattia, to his appearance in their first game of the season away at Verona, despite the fact that he was in the middle of chemotherapy and facing a bone marrow transplant, there he is, kind of looking a bit emaciated, but sitting there on the Bologna bench.
Yeah, and he'd kept a promise. You know, he said that he wanted to be there for the first game of the season. I think a lot of people thought he was mad, given that he was about to undergo and was undergoing three rounds of chemotherapy. But he would appear in between those rounds. You know, when he was discharged from hospital, you know, he wanted to be on the sidelines. And you know, in a pre-COVID world, they did everything to make sure that things were sanitized. He would turn up to the stadium with a mask because his immune system was vulnerable. But it was incredible seeing how Bologna's reacted when he was on the sidelines. Their results were much better when he was there. You know, he did a lot of delegating for what the first 4 to 6 months of the season. You know, his tactician, his assistant who he grew up with, Miroslav Tanja, yeah, they had to do the instruction for most of the games in that first half of the season without him. And then would kind of link up in the dressing room at halftime, and he would you know, either by kind of a Skype or a video conference would pass on his own thoughts. But I mean, it was very emotional to see the Bologna team, you know, when they won without him, they would go to the Sant'Orsola hospital in Bologna outside his window. And, you know, he would come out and they would sing songs. So, you know, obviously it was a very frightening time. You know, this is a very serious disease. And, you know, in you look back at the history of Italian football, and, you know, Tommaso Maestrelli, who was the coach of Lazio in the 70s, you know, he had, I think, cancer and came back, you know, whilst he thought he was still in remission. The cancer came back and he died while still kind of coaching Lazio. And there were fears that this might repeat itself with Mihajlovic. But, you know, luckily he's been able to come through this after a bone marrow transplant. And, yeah, touch wood, seems to be healthy.
Indeed so. Well, he talks a lot about his experiences in hospital, and a couple of things that he says helped get him through. One was Serbian folk music, in particular this song, Mdelja by Dej. Another thing was takeaway from his old friend Giuseppe Signori and his restaurant Il Campione in Bologna, which is absolutely terrific. Been there, and it was really, really good. And a third thing that kept his spirits up was something that his brother mentioned. His brother turned up after a really bad time and reminded him of the occasion when Sinisa Mihajlovic had been to see a fortune teller back in the old Yugoslavia. It was while he was playing for Red Star Belgrade. One of his teammates has gone along with a poster of Red Star, and the fortune teller's looked at it and gone, "Who's this?" And pointing at a picture of Mihajlovic, and they say, "That's Sinisa Mihajlovic." So the fortune teller looks at the person and says, "Tell him to come and see me right away. Within a week, he's going to have a car crash." Mihajlovic has a car crash within the week and immediately then goes to see the fortune teller, who comes up with a bunch of stuff, and they start a kind of working relationship, which involves her visiting the parents' home, removing some cursed objects which a former girlfriend has left behind. She warns him that the girlfriend is going to try and give him a present, and on no account must he touch the present. So he comes out of the house and she's there waiting with something in her hand. She says, "Sinisa." And he says, "No, I can't stop." So he's starting to walk fast. She's walking fast. He starts to run towards his car. She's running too. He jumps into the car. She throws the present into the car. He rings up the fortune teller and says, "Oh my God, she's given me the present." The fortune teller says, "Have you touched it?" He says, "No, I haven't touched it." She says, "Come here right now." So he drives 100 kilometers with this present, and she takes it and she makes a little kind of special confection of sugar and stuff. And she says, at the next full moon, literally, this is the story, at the next full moon, you have to shake this up and burn it. And then, you know, he never saw her again. So that completely worked. But amongst the things that fortune teller told Sinisa Mihajlovic is that when he was 50, he'd be very seriously ill, but then after that would have tremendous success. So there you go. Well, here's looking forward to all of that then, Sinisa Mihajlovic. It's been an extraordinary career so far, and who knows what is up next. James, do you feel differently about Sinisa?
Well, you were covering the league when he was a player. I think I've covered the league more when he's been a manager. And putting all the kind of things we've spoken about to one side, I've always found him really charismatic. You know, sometimes it feels a little bit forced. I remember when he was coach of Sampdoria, he would, you know, every press conference, it would be, "I've been reading JFK's biography today," or "I've been reading the latest book about Tesla." And he came across really cultured, which, again, I don't think is something that a lot of people would necessarily say, given what he himself has said in the past. So it's a rich tapestry that, you know, he is woven with lots of different kind of fabrics, which make him really a really kind of fascinating person to follow, really. And I think someone who has lived a genuinely fascinating life, in good and in bad. And I think that makes him a very compelling character. I mean, he's very open about it. "I'm not a hero."
I think most people probably don't agree with some of the things he's done, but I think the fact that he has apologised or recognised his mistakes probably makes a lot of people feel that he's worth appraising again after that. There you go, Sinisa Mihajlovic. If you want to know more about him, it is a very interesting read, his book, La Partita della Vita. I don't think it's actually out in English yet, but if your Italian's up to it, have a bang at that. Next time up, with Gabriele Marcotti returning, we delve once again into the rich history of Serie A and its golden years. Do make sure you join us for that. For now, though, it's many, many thanks to producer Charlie and to James Horncastle and you, listener, for being with us. We'll speak to you soon. For now, from all of us here, it's a rivederci. Campionato di calcio
italiano. You've been listening to Galazzo, the totally Italian football show. Check out all of The Athletic's podcasts on Apple, Spotify, and all the usual places, or listen ad-free on the Athletic app. Galazzo!
Marini's Media.